Welcome to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert Prechter. Bob is founder and president of Elliott Wave International, the world's largest independent financial forecasting firm. He's written 13 books on finance, including Elliott Wave Principal in 1978. At that time, he predicted a 1920 stock market boom. Did we ever get one? Took a few years, but oh, did we ever get one, the greatest one ever, that led to what appears to be ongoing, interrupted, up and down, whatever, the way these things work. But what appears to be, maybe when it's over and we look back, the greatest ever bust, well, we will see. His 2002 book is titled Conquer the Crash, and his newest, last time Bob was on, we talked about it. His newest is titled The Mania Chronicles, a real-time record of the great financial bubble 1995 to 2008. What a bubble it was, and I hope I live long enough to look back and with hindsight see just how big and bad this thing was and just how awful the fallout was. But we want to talk about Bob's latest views. Bob, I hope we're connected.
We are.
Oh, I welcome you back. It was 6 months ago that I had you on, and I really hoped I could get you back to get your current views. I thought this was enough time to have you come back on and assess what you see things happening right now. I think I know your long-term view, but let me let you jump in. And where do you see things now, and in the months ahead, where do you see them going?
Well, you mentioned something in your intro that I thought was interesting. You said, I hope I live long enough to see the aftermath of this thing. You know,
I'm 75 years old, Bob.
Okay, well, I'm 60, and I'm wondering if I'm going to live long enough. The Value Line Composite Index topped in April of 1998. That's 12 years ago. The Dow topped in January 2000. The S&P, in real terms, it topped in 1999 along with the S&P. Then we had sort of a double top with all the credit inflation of the mid-2000s. We had the double top in the 2007, a higher high in the Dow, an equal high in the S&P. And here we are again, back in outrageously, historically overvalued territory for the stock market. It's as if people don't want to let go of this credit fantasy that everything is great and all the credit they've created is still worth what it was worth when they originally issued it. It's an amazing thing to watch, but the outcome seems to me pretty much assured.
I can tell you why people believe it, Bob, because they listen to the major media and the business channels. You know well, they have you on once in a while. And they get the siren song that, you know, we had a bad downturn for a while, and now the crisis has passed. Thank you, Ben Bernanke. Thank you, Ben Bernanke. My goodness gracious. I'll throw in a comment about him. Economist Michael Hudson comes on this program and others. He calls him a useful idiot. Who probably never passed a basic economics course based on how bad his policies have been as Fed chairman. But that's another story. Let me let you get back to the central point of how awful things really are.
Well, one of the you just mentioned again, people are saying we're out of the woods, we're past it. The way that we forecast things, we don't use current economic data to try to figure out what's going on. That's what most economists do. And a year ago, back in the first quarter of 2009, we saw all the indications that the market was at a bottom from what we call wave count or Elliott wave structure to the extreme pessimism. We had 98% of traders, according to the MBH poll, thinking the market was going lower.
This is Cat Stadia, Public Radio.
Talking about his views, Bob, of the Elliott Wave International. Bob, sorry for the interruption. We have a few more, but we have a lot of time. And as much of this hour as you like, I think you like 30 minutes, but you can have the whole hour if you wish. But let me let you get back to the point you were making.
Yeah. All right. We were talking about the first quarter of 09 a year ago, and that's when so many signs were lining up from wave structure to extreme pessimism. We've never had a reading in the MBH poll of traders as low as 2% bulls in the S&P, but that's what happened on March the 9th of 2009. It was one of the reasons we got very bullish, but we said there's going to be a big bear market rally. Get ready, because by the end of it, everyone is going to be saying we're out of the woods economically, that the Fed has saved the financial system, and we can all relax. But that's the kind of thing you always get at tops. That's why nobody recognized the top in real estate in 05 or stocks in 2000 and 07. And we've got the same situation today. Everybody's saying we're out of the woods. And instead of extreme pessimism, which is what we had a year ago, we've got substantial optimism and have had for the last 3 months. Extreme overvaluation, all the signs, yet again, in the past 12 years, third major time that we've had a top indication in the stock market. And I think one of these days, probably in 2010 to 2011, this year, we're going to see the market finally give up and start going back to below normal historical valuations, which now would require something like a 50 to 80% drop in the averages to achieve. So if anything, you should be out of the stock market 100%.
Well, you're not the only one who says it. I have a couple of other people who come on this program and say the same things. And besides their own views, they quote others. A man you know about, he's never been on this program, Richard Russell. I guess he's one of the oldest of the old-timers.
Ah, he's the classic.
He's the classic. I think he's been doing this for 60 years, if I have the number right.
That sounds right.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, he started in 1958.
In 1958.
So that's about 52 years.
The number that was mentioned on one of my other programs is he's predicting the Dow at the bottom will go all the way back to 1,000.
Yeah. Well, I've been saying that for quite some time. And people say it's impossible because, oh, the Fed's going to inflate. But the credit structure is so huge and the amount of debt relative to GDP is so big that I think what's going to happen is all these IOUs are a big block of them anyway, is going to default. And the so-called money supply, which is mostly made up of credit, is going to implode. And that's why the subtitle of my book uses the word deflation. And when that happens, I think there's going to be a tremendous, rapid repricing of virtually everything in the economy, and especially investments such as stocks and real estate and commodities.
Another big issue that comes up on this program, Bob, is the fact that we have an enormous debt problem. And the reason economist Michael Hudson refers to Ben Bernanke as a useful idiot is because he's coped with this enormous debt crisis like a burning house, and he's thrown more gasoline on it. He's exploded debt to the extent unprecedented, certainly in this country's history. So, and I can remember reading one or more articles based on his policies referring to the dollar as toilet paper. Sooner or later, maybe, it will turn into toilet paper. I mean, this is serious stuff. And these are people who say, you know, whatever is going on now, the dollar has been rallying. Well, I guess it goes up and it goes down. And compared to the euro and the pound, Bob, maybe it's the best of the worst. But that's not exactly an endorsement. So maybe they're all going to run into an awful lot of trouble at some point down the road.
Well, first of all, the problem is debt. And as you pointed out, making more of it is not going to solve the problem. It just makes it worse. I don't lay all the blame at the feet of Bernanke. A lot of people like to personalize these things. But the real debt pusher throughout the past 70 years has been Congress. Congress has created these agencies whose sole job is to make sure that Americans get deeper and deeper into debt. They created the Federal Home Loan Banks, called it the American Dream, but of course in the long run it just ruins the American Dream. And then they created Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac, and Ginny Mae, and Sally Mae, and all of these sort of favored quasi-government corporations' main job is to get people more indebted to buy things such as houses and such as education, higher education. Now, what's happened to the prices as a result of all this credit? Prices in housing have soared to ridiculous levels where the average person absolutely can't even afford a house anymore without borrowing all the money. And you can't afford a higher education anymore without borrowing all the money. So the credit actually creates the problem that it's trying to solve. You can't solve it with more credit. And the only thing that's going to change what the political people are doing is a reversal of the trend toward increasing credit. And I think we have turned the corner on that. I think we turned the corner in 2005 when real estate started falling, but more dramatically in 2008 when commodities finally caved in. One of the reasons I'm very, very bullish on the dollar is it has nothing to do with the idea that the United States is in better shape than Europe or China or any other place on earth. It's due to one thing, and that is there's more debt that's been issued in dollar terms than in any other currency. So the dollar has the furthest to deflate. And as these credits, these IOUs become worthless and the corporate bonds start falling in value and the municipal bonds start falling in value and the consumer debt and mortgages start falling even further in value, that's going to be a disappearance of what people believe are dollars. And when the dust settles, whatever dollars remain are going to be able to buy more stuff, at least for a short period of time. I mean, that's when eventually you might have a risk of money printing and hyperinflation. But for the time being, we're a debt-based economy, and the government and the Fed have every desire to see that structure hold up. And I don't think they're going to, you know, start the printing presses until they see no other option, because they have to keep the bond market alive. Unfortunately, creating more debt is not going to do that. So they're between a rock and a hard place. They have only one solution, which is creating more IOUs, and that solution is the problem. As you pointed out, it's not going to fix anything. So we're at a precipice where the markets are trying to figure out how this is going to resolve. And when the Dow comes back under 10,000 for good, I think we'll get our answer.
Well, you make a very good point, Bob, especially something as important as real estate. The housing bubble absolutely popped, and it could keep popping for a good number of months ahead. A few months ago, I was emailed by somebody, I live in Chicago, emailed by somebody moving to Chicago asking my advice on where in the city or surrounding areas would be a good place to buy a home. And also wondering, where would the best values be? And, I'm not a real estate person, and I don't like giving advice. But my suggestion to this person was, move to Chicago and rent, because whatever home you may buy today, whatever price on a home you may want to buy today, a year or 2 years from now, I think for certain you'll be able to buy it cheaper. So why buy it now?
I agree 100%, and I've been giving the exact same kind of advice to people, and some of them even got out of their homes a few years ago and started renting, and I've gotten a few letters and emails from people who say, thankfully I sold, it wasn't top tick, but it was high enough, but my neighbors are in deep trouble, and they're wondering if they have to get out of their homes, and he said, we're just paying rent, and he said, in fact, the rents are starting to, slip a bit. There's so much extra real estate. People are trying to rent it so they can make the payments on their mortgages that the rentals are actually beginning to come down. So it's the way to go. And if you bide your time and hold on to your money, you'll be able to buy that real estate probably much like in the 30s. Homes dropped. People don't realize this, but some places dropped as much as 90%. Stuff that was selling for maybe $150,000 sold at $15,000. And there are, as you know, homes in Detroit right now for sale for a dollar.
Detroit is in very, very, very serious trouble. I wrote about Detroit. Possibly the unemployment rate is as high as 50%, and nobody wants to talk about that. But Detroit is an absolute disaster. It's almost at a point where maybe we should close down the city and reinvent a new one.
Well, it's very sad what happened in Detroit. I mean, the government backed the unions, and the unions got deals that worked fine as long as there was no competition from the rest of the world. But as soon as the rest of the world learned they could make cars, that was the end of the game. And so I think that's what ruined Detroit.
And the rest of the world made them better than Detroit made them. Detroit thought they could get away with less than ideal products for a lot of years. And when the Japanese and the Germans turned out superior products, well, the world changed. The world was the U.S.'s oyster, Bob, post-World War II through the 60s, and then it began to change. And it's a much different world today. Discussions on this program go on to the extent that America has been in a long-term decline. Other parts of the world, especially Asia, is rising. China, the best example, but other countries as well. And some of them run their countries better than we run ours. And again, when you have a problem, and every time you think you've fixed it, and things get better for a short period, and then you have a bigger problem, then something is wrong with your policies. So where is the government? Where are the regulators? Something is rotten in Denmark. Well, in Washington, on Wall Street. I don't know what's going on in Denmark, but things certainly aren't the way they should be here to run a country right, to run an economy right. And if that's the case, then the markets, especially stocks, sooner or later, there'll be some big problems. Well, we have another break, Bob. We'll come back. We have another segment. And if you want to stay on after that, you are most welcome. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm with Bob Rector. Bob's latest book again is The Mania Chronicles, a real-time record of the great financial bubble, 1995 to 2008. And, Bob, I think for certain when we look back, we'll see that period, maybe late 2007. I guess the recession officially began in December 2007, whatever that means. But that will really be an historic point. Let me raise two points with you, and I'd like your comments on it. Number one, the Greek crisis, the Greek tragedy, and the possible contagion effect. We'll come back to that. Number two, this scares the dick. Well, that scares the dickens out of me. So does this, the record collapse in credit. Let me read you some numbers I'm looking at right now. In the last week, $30 billion in bank lending contracted. In the first 6 weeks of 2010, $100 billion contracted, a historic 16% annualized decline. Since the crisis began, $740 billion of bank credit has just evaporated, a record 10% decline. I mean, this is shocking stuff, and it's broad-based. Consumer loans, real estate, and commercial and industrial loans, the stuff is really going down in double digits. I mean, this scares the devil out of me. I imagine you too.
Well, this was the whole theme of the book that I wrote in 2002, and this is way before all this stuff came to the fore. I said we are at the precipice of an unprecedented debt collapse, and it's not only did we see it in the mortgages back in 2008, and we're going to see it in so many other areas. But you just mentioned Greece. Well, Greece is a sovereign government, and now it's beginning to be clear that they're not going to be able to pay on their debt. They've just got IOUs out there that they never even thought about how to pay off, and people are starting to realize that. And one of the big questions is this going to boomerang back far enough to affect even the debt of the U.S. government, which is now spending money at the greatest rate that it's ever done? They don't get the problem. They're making it worse. And this is, again, what the markets are trying to figure out is how this is going to resolve. But one thing I want to make sure we do in our last couple minutes here is talk about what people should do.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, one of the things that people need to relearn, because deflations are very rare. People are so used to inflationary periods that they don't know how to deal with them, is that you can't diversify into a whole bunch of different investments to make it through this portion of the cycle. In this time, as in the early 1930s, all investments tend to fall during a deflationary period, while the only thing holding its value is cash. So you want to avoid real estate. As you mentioned earlier, lower prices are coming. You want to avoid the stock market. It's historically overvalued, and way lower prices are coming there. And I think you want to avoid most commodity-type investments, and this is the really the complicated part, you have to avoid most debt because a lot of it's not going to get paid. California can't pay its debt already, and I think many other cities, counties, and states have that kind of difficulty ahead. So how do you do it? You have to get into cash and the safest cash equivalents you can find, and you have to hold them in the safest possible institutions. The whole second half of my book, Conquer the Crash, is a careful description of how you can go about getting your money safe. It's not as easy as most people think. But a couple of the highlights are you want real greenback-type cash, you know, stashed away safe somewhere. You want to have your money not necessarily in banks. You might want to look at things such as treasury-only money market funds. There are only two left, and only one that I know left that's still accepting new clients. And what you can do there, instead of having all your money invested by the bank in mortgages, you have invested by the fund into only short-term treasury bills, which are probably the one item that the government's going to want to keep funding, if any.
Can I throw in one question, Bob?
Yeah.
What is the possibility of the FDIC going bust and your FDIC-insured bank account may not be insured if your bank goes bust, including big ones?
Well, I think the chances of that are so high that I don't want to risk being in the banking system. You know, they were set up to handle maybe a half a dozen bad banks a year, and they're already out of money. Banks are still going under every couple of weeks. One in our state goes under. And if 1,000 or 2,000 banks suddenly report that they're insolvent, the FDIC won't be able to cover it. They're going to rush to the government. The government's already so in debt. What are they going to do? It's an impossible situation. And I say, why get yourself caught up in that? So that's why a money market fund, specifically treasury only, is a way safer way to go.
And you can write checks on it, not small ones, but checks over
$250. Yeah, $250, exactly. So you can keep a small bank account funded with that.
You can certainly pay your rent with your treasury money market.
You can, yes. And for smaller purchases, you know, you keep $1,000 in the bank just as long as it's there to pay those.
Well, it's a very scary time. Again, I'm 75. I mean, in small business, in my former working life, I remember hard times, but, you know, they lasted a year or so, they passed, and they rock small businesses, but somehow we managed to keep afloat and stay in business until we sold out. But the times that we're going through right now, I've never seen anything like this. I never thought I would, and I'm absolutely terrified at how this is going to play out in the months and years ahead. I think you are as well.
Well, I think as long as you've got your finances safe, you can deal with the other problems that are coming.
Should we wrap it up here, or would you like to stay over?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to wrap it up. I think we covered a lot of great topics.
We covered an awful lot. I'd love to get you back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Director, regular listeners have heard others on this program, Michael Hudson, Jack Rasmus, others who have expertise on the economy, on finance. They pretty much say the same things. We don't usually talk about markets and investment advice on this program. That's not the purpose. The purpose is really to assess the state of the country, the state of the world, economically, politically, and so on. Regular listeners know that. But I stress just for myself and my own writing and guests who've come on this program that I have never seen anything like this in my life, and I never dreamed I ever would. I can remember back when I was much younger and first in school, and then going into the workforce full time, a newly minted MBA in 1960, a much different world than the one we have today. They were really, I didn't enter the workforce at the best time economically. The economy was a little weak, as I remember. Even in a somewhat weak, I forget if we were in recession or not, I finished up, or I took an accelerated course, and I went one summer. I was tired of being a starving student, and I wanted to go out and earn a little money. So I graduated in February. I finished up everything at the end of 1959. My goodness, Dwight Eisenhower was president, if people remember that far back. And beginning of February, I graduated and off to the workforce. Well, even in that less than ideal economic time, I didn't have any trouble finding a job. And I never did thereafter, including the recessions that I remember. After about 7 years, I got involved in a small family business. And we went through some tough times occasionally. Small business always has it meaner and nastier than the big ones. And a few times things were tough enough that they nearly put us under. But somehow we survived. The worst of the economic crises we went through, oh, maybe lasted a year or so, and things turned around, and we came back strong. This one is like a unprecedented tsunami, and how much devastation it will cause before it's all over, who can know? But the excesses are so great, and the policies are so bad, that at best they can only paper them over for a time. You pour enough money into the system, and for a while the stimulus, and it will make things look better than in fact they are. But all of the so-called economic games, GDP wise, and so on, is attributable to the stimulus. The stimulus can't go on forever. The excesses become greater excesses, and finally, when the stimulus abates or ends, it's like letting air out of a balloon. That's about the best analogy that comes to my mind. So what do you do under situations like that? Well, we as ordinary mere mortals, ordinary people, we don't make policy. We have to live with its results. We have to cope the best way we can. What does government do? The people who make these policies aren't stupid. They know what they're doing. Well, of course, they sold out to the corporate interests long ago with Wall Street at the head of the pecking order. We know that. They get the most, and they always get the most, and that goes back many decades, but especially over the last three or four, the financialization of the country with the big financial interests, the fire sector, financial, real estate, insurance, and real estate. They come first. But the others are there as well. So business gets bigger and more powerful. They get the benefits, just ordinary subsidies year after year, plus handouts when they need it, especially to the favored ones. And we sit holding the bag. Eventually another crisis will come. I mean, I don't know how long this thing is going to go on. Bob mentioned that we might see things erupt this year. Others are looking for something absolutely to erupt sometime during this year, and maybe worse in 2011, and possibly the worst of all after that, with some horrible things that I read on how bad conditions may get and what may go on. Well, if really terrible times erupt worse than we've seen so far, one of the things that scares me is you need to distract the public. What is the best way to do it? Create another terrible dictator who is literally threatening our existence. So we had Saddam and the Iraq War in 2003. A lot of rhetoric is being stoked about Iran right now. I discount that completely, at least to the extent that I've been hearing it for the last three, 4 years or longer. on and off, and a fleet, one fleet or another, getting deployed to the Persian Gulf or thereabouts. Really, an array of combat ships. And other things as well, and Iran accused of everything under the sun except global warming. Maybe they've been accused of that too, I don't know. But it's possible that so far it's been all crying wolf. I suspect it's still crying wolf. But what if it isn't one day? What if Iran is attacked? It would be a devastating mistake, but it sure would be distracting for a while. The Haiti situation is another thing that absolutely has my focus. I've written 7 articles about Haiti. I've had a couple of programs on Haiti. I have another scheduled around the end of this month, before the end of this month, the last week of February. I guess that's next week, February being a short month. On the 25th of February, I'll have another program on Haiti. My 7th article I call Haiti is Open for Business. I see a terrible scenario unfolding there. Now, that is not a distracting event that's going on. It doesn't focus the attention of people in this country to make them think that, we have to pay attention to that situation first before we worry about the economic plight of ordinary people at home. But what's going on in Haiti is certainly something that is planned to benefit U.S. Moneyed interests, to say the least. Haiti is an oil-rich country. It's been known about for many decades. The potential is considered possibly huge, which is quite surprising. So you have to wonder why, if Haiti has so much oil, I think most of it offshore, close to shore, in deep water off the Haitian coast, also the Dominican Republic coast. If all that oil is there, why hasn't somebody gone after it to exploit? Well, the reason in my mind is simple. Why bother when there's so much of it in so many other places? So, you know, let's first get all we can out of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran and other places that have a lot. And as we pass the peak in those countries, then maybe it's time to go after untapped resources. Haiti absolutely is one of them. Listeners might be surprised to learn that an estimated 20 billion barrels has been found in deep water off Cuba. So Cuba is an oil-rich country. I expect Cuba to get more attention from us in the months ahead. Cuba has always had our attention on and off. But I expect there to be more attention if they have 20 billion barrels of oil that we want to get our hands on. Controlling it. That's the issue. Controlling it and getting our oil companies first dibs on developing. So Haiti is under occupation. We put in 20,000 troops. I just read they're going to bring the number down to 13,000. I don't know how many they need. Security is not the issue in Haiti. Security isn't the issue at all. Except to the extent of protecting the minority, the tiny minority rich Haitians from the mass majority impoverished ones who have comported themselves astoundingly well given the conditions that they're under right now. They're literally starving to death. Make no mistake about it. And we'll discuss this more on the next program and probably more in Haiti because this is not going away in a hurry. And the reason I come back to it, even though the topic for this program was the economy, Haitians are being exploited more than ever before. And the plan is to literally suck all the life out of that country, get rid of as many Haitians as possible. I believe they're being starved to death. I call it slow motion genocide. Lots of aid donors have stepped up to the plate to try to help. So little has been done for most of the ones in need. Roughly maybe 3 million Haitians are affected by this quake. Most of them are living out in the open, no shelter, no tents, no nothing. The poor communities in Haiti, the best known one to people who know Haiti, Cité Soleil, has gotten virtually nothing as of at least late last week So I expect, as of this moment, they've gotten virtually nothing. Patients need to make out as best they can on their own. So the U.S. military did not arrive in Haiti to help the people. It arrived to help the elite of Haiti and to serve U.S. interests, as we do wherever we show up. And I think the reason that a third of the force is being withdrawn is they need them in Afghanistan. I think that's what's behind it. And there we have a battle raging that whatever the results of it, it won't decide anything. That war will go on forever and ever and ever until we finally give up and realize it's hopeless and pull out, just like the Russians did at the end of the 1980s. So we have that horrible situation. We have the Haitian situation. We have the Iraq situation that you don't hear many of the reports of car bombs going off every day, of Iraqis being killed. The situation pretty grim, and I only can see it getting worse, not better, plus the festering Afghan situation and all the rest going on. What this country is using its resources for, its money, our tax dollars, the largest ever military budget, besides the $700-plus billion defense authorization Obama wants, we have all the supplementals. Who knows how many there'll be? Figure another couple of hundred billion or more. We have the black budgets. We have all the all the intelligent budgets, plus the black ones on top of the black ones. Homeland Security. We're talking about well in excess of $1 trillion being spent on defense, security, and related matters. It could be $1.2 trillion. And we can only guess what the black budgets are, but maybe throw in another couple of hundred billion. So we're pushing flank speed toward $1.5 trillion on security. We don't have an enemy in the world. We're throwing many trillions at Wall Street. The estimates I've seen on what they have already gotten are roughly $12-13 trillion. The TARP administrator, Trouble Asset Relief Program administrator, Neil Barofsky, has said that banks have either gotten have been pledged $23.7 trillion. Who can comprehend numbers like that? Well, you throw money around like that for defense and the banks, and there isn't anything left over for anybody else. So Obama proposed in his State of the Union message a 3-year budget freeze on discretionary domestic spending. Well, you know what that means. Necessary aid for needy people. Forget about them. Forget about people going hungry, homeless, losing their homes. Forget about all those things. We don't have any money for it. We're too busy fighting wars against enemies we don't have. We're too busy occupying Haiti instead of doing what, one thing I left out of the Haiti story. And I wrote an article about this. I don't know. I have no proof. And I didn't say I know in the article I wrote. But I wrote an article questioning whether the earthquake was natural or engineered. And what I do know is we have the technology to create earthquakes. I think we have several technologies to create earthquakes and floods and tsunamis and forest fires and extreme weather changes. So if we want to do it, we can do it. And I think the timing of this Haitian quake is very, very suspect. There's no question that Haiti, that Port-au-Prince, the capital, sits atop a dangerous fault line. That's been known for ages. Nobody did anything. Nobody did anything to keep people from building in extremely dangerous places, like along hillsides, where if there's a quake, everything's going to come tumbling down, and what's up top will come crashing on what's below it. So everything comes tumbling down. So all those hill sites, steep ones, with all those homes built on them, I imagine they're all gone now, or at least so wrecked that they're certainly not able to house anybody. Well, this was known. Nothing was done. No preparation was done. I mean, you have to prepare, because sooner or later a quake will come. in one article, I mean, in the last 500 years, the Haiti region was hit with 7 catastrophic quakes. The last one was in 1946, an 8.0 that mostly struck the Dominican Republic, and only 1,600 people were killed. From an 8.0 quake, the Haitian one was 7.0, or 7.1, 7.2, I've seen different numbers. Pretty severe. But it really slammed right into Port-au-Prince. All those people crammed together in very fragile quarters, and the acknowledged toll, it's an estimate, I think it's way too low, 230,000. I think the number probably is well over 300,000. And nothing was done to help those people trapped, not under rubble, but behind rubble. Under was too late. Behind, we could have gotten them out if we got every equipment, and we simply didn't do it. We let them die. We want them to die. Too many Haitians, 9 million. Who needs them? Who needs them? We want cheap labor, but we don't need that much. So to get rid of 1 million or 2 or 3, oh, that would be ideal. We don't have to worry about the 6 million Haitians. So I describe it as, well, very fast slaughter from the quake and slow motion genocide subsequent to it for the next year, 2 years. And in my new article, I made a guesstimate that by the end of this year or maybe next, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Haitians will have needlessly died because we engineered it and we let them die. Another break. I'll come back. We'll finish up. Final thoughts. Lots of topics to talk about, and we sure will keep doing it.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Final segment. What was today? Today is Tuesday. I completely forgot yesterday was a holiday. I thought about it about 5 minutes before I went on air. It's kind of one of those not quite holidays, but any event, it was just another day at the ranch for me. My days are pretty much the same. I seem to get involved in doing an awful lot of writing and, of course, this program, and I get asked to do a fair number of interviews. This week especially, my goodness, I was asked to do several, and yesterday I did my first ever YouTube. I never did YouTube before, but did one. I didn't realize that my Skype had video capabilities. And, amazing, there's one available. I don't know how to tell you to find it. I have a link. I can't send listeners a link verbally. I wish I could. I don't know how to explain how people might do it. It was on this woman who was just convicted of shall I say terrorist related crime, Afia Siddiqui. Afia is absolutely innocent. Months back, I had her lawyer on this program talking about her. She is the most abused person I know who was taken fraudulently into U.S. custody, accused of bogus charges, imprisoned at Bagram in Afghanistan for 5 years, brutally tortured and raped. They actually destroyed this woman. They destroyed her, this magnificent woman, an MIT grad, a PhD from Brandeis University in Boston in neurocognitive science. She had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism or even close to it. It was like arresting the corner butcher and charging him or her with terrorism or something or other. They picked her up. They abused. They took advantage, and now they destroyed her. And they always intimidate juries to convict. And on the YouTube, I explained that what they claim she did was so preposterous that if somebody wrote it in a Hollywood script, the producer would laugh the person out of his office. She was at Bagram. She was behind a curtain. She was there with 5 or 6 U.S. personnel, soldiers, an FBI agent, I think CIA, I think a translator. She spoke English. I don't know what they needed a translator for. and she peeked out of the curtain. They claimed that somehow this woman was so weak. She was extremely fragile, weighs 110 pounds. They claimed that she got the rifle away from one of the soldiers. Imagine this. Open fire at close range. Hit nobody. There were no bullet casings. There was no DNA evidence. The weapon was never fired. This all came out in court. Somehow, she hit no one. The only person who was hit was her. Another soldier or whatever opened fire on her, hit her twice, nearly killed her. She had no idea what was going on. The last thing that she recalled was she was on a stretcher. So everything became a blur. But yet they charged her. These were the charges against her. These were not the original charges that weren't in the indictment, as I recall. The original ones were pathetic. Oh, my God, I could go on and on about this. All of this will come up in future programs. All of these important topics that we need to know about. What's impossible to get in the major media, you know that. That's why you've got to listen to programs like this and a few others like it. We're out of time. Ernie Hancock next. We'll be back tomorrow. Please join us.